De la revolución del mundo. Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Why don't we go ahead and get rolling. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're really happy to have you here. This panel is thinly attached to this book that I wrote, which is on sale here, although technically it's not out for another week. So you guys can get an early advance, whatever, and I will go sign books after this panel if any of you want. And I'm excited to be here because the last book that I wrote came out in lockdown and I didn't get to do any of this for it. So it's really nice to see like faces looking back at me and not just be on Zoom, even if I can't tell if you're smiling or frowning under your masks. So I'm Sarah Jaffe. I am a journalist. I am the author of Necessary Trouble, Work Won't Love You Back, and this book. First, I'm going to introduce my panelists because then I'm going to talk for a few minutes and then make you talk to each other. So first off, Iman Abdelhadi is an academic, activist, and writer who thinks at the intersection of gender, sexuality, religion, and politics. She is an assistant professor and sociologist at the University of Chicago and co-author of Everything for Everyone, an oral history of the New York Commune. Yeah, that's right. It's really good. An oral history of the New York Commune, 2052 to 2072, a sci-fi novel published in 2022 with Common Notions Press. And she and I met this summer only, so she is not in this book, although I wish she was. But we hit it off, talked a lot about feelings, and I love her. Kelly, we're going with the feelings, guys. Kelly Hayes, who I also love, is a Menominee author, organizer, movement educator, and photographer. She is the host of Truth Out's podcast, Movement Memos, and that's right. We can have good feelings too. Co-author of the book Let This Radicalize You. We definitely need a whoop for that one, right? And with Miriam Kaba, who we all love. And Kelly is also the creator of Organizing My Thoughts, a weekly newsletter about politics and justice work. And last but very much not least, Lydia Pelo-Hobbs is an assistant professor of geography and African American and Africana studies at the University of Kentucky. Her research and teaching is focused on the carceral state, racial capitalism, feminist and queer politics, grassroots social movements, abolition geographies, disaster and climate justice, and the U.S. South. And she is my neighbor in New Orleans, and I love her very much as well. And her book, Prison Capital, is also on sale in the store upstairs, right?
Kind of?
Okay. Well, you should buy it on the internet if you can't get it here. So I wrote this book about grief because my father died in 2018, and it completely turned my life upside down in ways that I did not expect. And everything that I read about grief was totally wrong. Totally, totally full of terrible cliches and so wrong. And then, of course, I'm a journalist and I cover social movements, I cover labor, and I was seeing grief in everything. I was in Lordstown, Ohio for the closure of the Lordstown plant in 2018. And the then president of the local, who's now the regional director for the UAW in that area, sort of flops on the couch while I'm interviewing one of his colleagues and says, like, you know, they say there are 7 stages of grief, but we can't go through them because the company won't tell us what's actually going on. And I was like, oh, right, that's why I'm drawn to writing about these factory closures. We're talking about grief. And I also started to think that grief is fundamentally disruptive to capitalism as a... Yeah, that's right. As a social structure, among other things, that will not let us pause, that will not let us be human, and that cannot care if we die, that literally will just plug the next person in on the assembly line if somebody drops dead. Grief, which is really disruptive to everyday life, is potentially revolutionary. So the book is roughly structured, well, it's very structured around five subjects. The first is state violence. It is the movement for Black Lives and Palestine. The second chapter is about migration and specifically focusing on what people leave behind when they move, since we tend to talk about people who migrate as a problem for the place they land rather than the problems that the places they land caused for the place they left. Deindustrialization, as I mentioned, obviously the COVID pandemic, and of course, climate change and climate catastrophe. And all of these organizers that I was speaking with were telling me they're thinking about questions of grief and care and time, and grief time particularly, as something that we need to, that grief will come when it comes. It will not be on a clock. It will not sit for you sitting Shiva if you're Jewish like me. It will not respect your work day. It will kick your ass when it feels like kicking your ass. And the only thing that will make it better is to have the time to sit and experience it and feel it and let it take you when it wants to take you. And the question of how do we make spaces for this? How do we build movements that can accommodate grieving and other forms of feeling, the things that make us human, while also managing to maintain a strategic focus so we actually win and overturn this death-making system some point? Yeah, that was the question that kept coming up for me, for everyone that I spoke with, and that's the question at the heart of this book. But as I said, since we're all going to get vulnerable and talk about feelings here, the book is kind of a memoir. And the reason I did that was I felt like I couldn't ask people to tell me about the worst things that ever happened to them without sharing with them the worst things that ever happened to me. And I had to put that on the page as well as in the interviews. I had to bring it with me everywhere because otherwise I was just a monster. I was just holidaying in other people's pain. And to that end of being vulnerable with all of you and with each other, I want to ask everybody to take a couple of minutes and just talk to somebody, make some new friends if you're not sitting with people you know. And I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to talk to each other about how grief has affected your life and how maybe it's affected your organizing, or maybe there hasn't been room for it in your organizing. So cool. I will tell you when to stop, but yeah, make some new friends for a couple of minutes. If you can hear me, clap once. You can hear me, clap twice. Look at me doing that like I'm an actual organizer or something. Anyway, thank you for doing that for me. It looked like you were really enjoying it, so that's great. So I'm going to let my panelists take it away a little bit and just talk for a couple of minutes about why they're here. So, Imad, go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for convening us, Sarah. And I just want to say that, first of all, this book is gorgeous, and thank you for writing it. I'm usually like a speed reader, and I kept having to put it down, which I think is a testament to how beautiful it is and how much I want to sit with it. I think that we, so there's many ways that I want to think together today about grief. But one of the things that I want us to sort of celebrate as a baseline is that we're doing collective grief right now in this room in a society that is constantly pushing our grief into atomized, you know, either into ourselves as something that we have to sort of like deal with, figure out, heal, and then reemerge into society as the perfect workers and mostly workers, really. That's really all they care about. Or into these dyadic relationships that are characterized by our relationships to psychology or psychiatry, right? And there's been so little. My co-author from Everything for Everyone, Emmy O'Brien, has... Yes! We love her! Has often pointed out that we have gone through so much collective trauma, and there have been no invitations for us to talk about the dead bodies in the trucks by our houses during COVID, right? There's been no memorials. There's been no conversation. There's been no attempt, right, to get together and say, like, we all just witnessed a thing. We just lost millions of people as a collective. And we can, and that situation, right, is something we experience as a collective and can deal with as a collective, right? The fact that we reserve memorializing and collective grief for state violence, right, is not insignificant, is not coincidental. So just as a baseline for our conversation, I wanted us to just take a moment to remember that we're doing the thing right here, right now, that we are not, that we so desperately need and have needed and keep needing over and over because we are in a world of perpetuating crises, but that we have not been given any space for by the society, and we're creating that space. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm really excited to share various scattered thoughts with you as the panel proceeds. And more than anything, I'm excited to hear from these wonderful people.
Thank you so much for that. I'm Kelly Hayes, and I'm also going to be pretty scattered today. Appreciate people's patience with that. I, like Sarah, was transformed by the loss of my father, who died in 2017, quite unexpectedly. Just as he had, in many ways, shaped who I became in life, his death really was deeply transformative for me. It changed the way that I looked at life itself. It changed the way I functioned in my relationships. It changed what I wanted out of my romantic relationships. And it absolutely affected my sense of what we owe to each other as people. And, you know, and that was a gift in some ways, and also one of the worst, if not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And so reading about Sarah's experiences in the book, I felt so seen, and I deeply appreciate your vulnerability in the book. And just the beauty of this text. It's a truly beautifully written book, and it felt so important to connect with these ideas being expressed so profoundly. So I just wanted to name that appreciation for this book. I also want to speak a little bit to something that happened yesterday when I was leading a workshop, and I was talking to one of the small groups in the workshop who were grappling with a particular question. And someone brought up that they were trying to create sort of care spaces within their organizing for people to deal with the fact that they're consuming all of this terrible news and terrible imagery about the genocide in Palestine that they are trying to stop. And they were saying, like, look, we need to make some space for our humanity and to take care of each other, or this is going to burn us out. And that someone kind of shot back at them, like, we don't have the right to center our feelings about this. You know, we don't, like, who are we? Look at what they're enduring in Palestine. How can we stop and think about our feelings when these people are suffering in this way? I was like, okay, first of all, I'm be the first to admit that I couldn't endure what people are enduring in Palestine. I would probably be one of those already gone for a number of reasons if I were there. And I certainly also know that I could not do what it is that I owe politically to my Palestinian siblings if I were enduring those conditions. My responsibility is to act, to understand and to act. And I must maintain the conditions that make that possible. And part of that is honoring my humanity. So when we talk about grief, one of the things that we are talking about is nurturing the parts of ourselves that are still soft enough to feel it. There are so many people all around us who are not feeling what we're feeling. And that's horrifying. When all of it is coming through and you're processing it and you're aching and hurting all the time and people are just proceeding obliviously, it feels like you're living in a fucking horror movie. Yeah. Yeah. It feels like something evil has taken hold, and it has. Yeah. And so I feel a very important part of our work is recognizing the fact that this stuff still hurts us, it matters. We have to protect the parts of ourselves that make that possible.
to shame the very impulses, the very feelings that motivate us to show up again and again against impossible odds in the face of constant repression. And amid these feelings that no matter what we do, it's not enough. Being able to hold the reality that it's not enough and also the reality that it's wholly necessary, that requires a lot of emotional balance. It requires a lot of community care. And if we're not real about those needs, if we're not real about our humanity, and the fact that we could all so easily get sucked into this culture of forgetting, we are all vulnerable to that. And we don't want to admit that about ourselves, but we are all vulnerable to that. People harden overnight because it is our body and mental impulse to protect ourselves. We can't, stress destroys the body. It is so hard to walk around fully activated all the time. Eventually, the body and mind adjust and things normalize. And we have to start getting really intentional about what we let in, what we make room for, and not letting go of our connection to what hurts. It becomes a practice. We have to take that practice seriously. And part of what makes that practice possible is sustaining ourselves, making sure there's still room for joy, making sure there's room to comfort each other, making sure that we're creating a culture around what that even means to us, because this society hasn't given us that. So those are just some opening thoughts that I wanted to share.
Thank you so much for all of that. So I want to reiterate what has already been said, but Sarah's book is a true gift. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of slowly also reading it. I also had the pleasure of talking with Sarah routinely, basically through the whole process of writing the book. Mm-hmm. And Sarah kept saying, "Is it too much? Does anyone care about grief?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Sarah, who doesn't care? This book is right on time. It is what we need." And the vulnerability that you bring to the text is incredible, right? So many of us who write books, right, we write books at a distance, and there is something profound, beautiful, deeply feminist, unabashedly so, right, in this commitment to actually saying, I am a person who is messy and has feelings of all kinds of ways that, of course, show up in also the reporting that I do, right, which is not how journalists are supposed to be, but is the deepest kind of journalism that I think that we can have. So I want to really encourage everyone to please go get Sarah's book yesterday if you don't have it already. It is a true gift for all of us. So as Sarah mentioned, I've lived full to part-time of my life in New Orleans for about the last 18 years. And New Orleans is a city that grief is everywhere. And I mean grief is everywhere on multiple registers. So if anyone heard me say this yesterday, today is September 1st, which means we are 19 years and now 3 days since the federal levee breaks that led to the drowning of New Orleans. It also means that, you know, we are approximately 14 years and a handful of months since the BP oil spill took away all kinds of lifeways for all kinds of people across the Gulf Coast. And I could rattle off so much more. And so I say this because there are a couple of truths that New Orleans has taught me in these years and this time, right? One is the ways in which the grief of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast that looks like sometimes acute crisis, like when a levee breaks or when the BP's, the oil is getting pumped into the Gulf of Mexico for over a month without any end in sight. The city smelled and the area smelled of oil during that time. It's really hard to explain what those days felt like. But also, it's a place that knows how to talk about grief in public and to express grief in public, right? What it means to be in a city where it is commonplace for there to be jazz funerals, for people to publicly actually have a cultural tradition that stretches back to the Jim Crow years, right? During an incredibly other, very difficult political moment, right? It's no coincidence that is the time that this tradition comes into being, of people being able to both march with the dirges in the street, and then in the kind of parlance of New Orleans, at the point of the internment of the body to let loose and then to also have the joy, right? So how do we actually have those spaces of both deep feelings? And then what does it also mean that those are also traditions that get brought into political protests and all kinds of other things to be able to hold it at a time when I keep thinking about this. For instance, in the days after Hurricane Katrina, in the months, it was very common to be told, folks in New Orleans, to be told by folks nationally to stop having so many feelings, right? That their feelings were getting in the way. And again, if we don't remember, we never knew, 80% of the city was underwater. The city was evacuated, and you could not enter the city for months and months and months. There was not water supply, right? And people's houses, literally, I will never forget, right, were on their sides in the streets in much of the city. And in this context, right, you had well-intentioned, good leftists showing up at leftist health clinics and putting up signs that said, less tears, more action, right? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? And can you imagine that not only for what that read to all of the kinds of New Orleanians who are coming in for healthcare in one of the most incredibly stressful contexts that one can be, but also what that meant for the folks who are experiencing in very true and profound ways all of the kinds of secondary trauma that those of us who did not experience the storm directly but experienced the months aftermath of it is to also shut down those feelings, right, in that political moment, right? And to keep it, I think it's so well hardened up, right? What does it mean to not want to feel what it's like? And I'm not from New Orleans. My godmother's from New Orleans, but I still remember, right, the first time I drove into the city post-Katrina, having to pull over on the side of the road and start sobbing of what the city actually looked like, right? And knowing that there are so many ways that that was something that at that time still felt like it had to be done in private, right? And that was less important. And what does that actually do for us long-term as various kinds of climate crises are just keep coming? So how do we actually hold the space for these kinds of movements? There's a lot of other things I want to say also about the ways in which state violence and criminalization also create those spaces. But also how do we hold the space for the feeling, not as a hindrance, right, but a way that really helps to fortify and deepen our relationships that we need for this kind of long-haul organizing work. I'll stop there.
You see why I love them, right? Can we just, if there's a seat open next to you, can you raise your hand? Because we've got people standing and there's plenty of seats in here. All right. If you guys are, if anybody wants to find a seat, we've got seats. Thank you. New Orleans shaped me. I went to school there 20 odd years ago and then moved back 3 years ago. So New Orleans helped make me the person who wrote this book. Being Jewish, frankly, helped make me the person that wrote this book. My years of doing various political work in the U.S. South, in the Northeast, in various other places. Now, lately, it's been England and Ireland. And so often, it was finding communities, making community with people who had been, in some way or another, rendered ungrievable by the system. And I'm stealing that word from Judith Butler, of course, and their work on grief. But capitalism really, I mean, mostly it renders all of us ungrievable, but that is, as Ruthie Gilmore would say, right, not evenly distributed. It is a group-differentiated vulnerability. So in different ways, all three of you have written about and organized with and in and are part of communities that have been rendered ungrievable. And I'd love to ask each of you if that concept resonates with you and what can we learn from that work to build an anti-capitalist movement that actually really values, again, all of the facets of human life. And let's go in reverse order now. So Lydia, back to you.
Thank you. It's such a profound question to start with, and I really appreciate it. So much of my work has historically and contemporarily been around organizing against police and prisons and incarceration and the carceral state in all of its different forms. And that was true before the storm or before Katrina, but it was really heightened in the moments when the New Orleans City Jail was left, was abandoned to the floodwaters. And I think when I was reflecting on this question about ungrievability, what immediately jumped to my mind is what it meant that, for instance, we know that people died in that jail and it has never been officially recorded. So I'm thinking about also what does it mean to think about those that are never even deemed to have died in the first place, whose deaths are hidden and forgotten, obfuscated, the lies that are told, right? the ignoring of statistics, right? And the very famously, right, there were staff, there were correctional officers that reported that they saw bodies in the water, bodies, not people trying to survive. And it was reported to folks, various lawyers and various other sorts. And when it was announced, the sheriff, right, claimed it was lies and it has never been recorded as a truth. I also think about the various kinds of both of police violence that was enacted with folks against her and during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, that were the ways in which, particularly on the Danziger Bridge, where a number of folks were shot down by the cops as they were searching for provisions, as they were trying to find out if their family members were still alive. Two people died. And in that moment, the story became, right, that there were looters. There were martyrs. They were in the streets. They were lawless. And the initial news report of these people's deaths and also the people who were shot was that the NOPD headquarters sounded a cheer when they heard that these shots had been fired successfully, right? So I also think about how state violence creates the conditions under which those who are being killed, murdered, by the state, right, are blamed for the state violence enacted against them, right, as a fundamental ways of whose lives are deemed meaningful, as needing to be cared for, and those who are fundamentally justified, and in all of these contexts, obviously, always already tied up in the anti-Black racism, right, that renders some people, as Sarah said, right, vulnerable to premature death. And so I'm going to stop there, but just really thinking, too, about these two different pieces, right? So one hand, right, one, whose lives even get counted, right, as having been lost, and also the ways in which certain people in certain places at certain times are blamed for the state violence enacted against them.
So I don't usually use the language of ungrievable in my work, not because it's not valid, but because in my experience, the sort of dehumanization and erasure of our humanity begins well before death. Mm-hmm. And so I'm usually talking about things in this more holistic way in terms of the process that even makes that possible. I want to say a couple words about fascism. As we know, there are elements of fascism woven into the fabric of our society, right? Even in the absence of something like a MAGA movement, Nazi Germany took multiple points of inspiration from the United States, from its concept of homeland and expansion, from the genocide of my people, from the realities of Jim Crow. Does that mean that the United States is inherently fascist? I would argue no. Not everything that is settler colonialism, not everything that is oppressive and even annihilatory is necessarily specifically fascism. But the elements are there, right? And as Ruth Wilson Gilmore has talked about, we do live in a moment now where we have this openly sort of fascistic movement vying for power. And on the other side, a party that wants to basically domesticate elements of fascism to make them more palatable to the public. And so within any form of fascism, you have people who are considered subhuman. You have people who are scapegoated and sort of targeted for annihilation, displacement, all of these things. And we are seeing the expansions right now of who is considered subhuman and who is considered disposable in the pursuit of not even greatness, but normalcy. So I spend a lot of time thinking about this. You know, with the MAGA movement, we have trans people as subhuman. We have migrants absolutely as subhuman. And so we have this advancing sort of threshold on who really doesn't have a right to exist or be among us and who is responsible for other people's hurt, such that folks are given license to take delight in the bad things that happen to these people. And then on the other side, you have this normalization of, you know, calls for tougher border restrictions, the criminalization of homelessness, which we know is a bipartisan product, and that liberal mayors are some of the primary innovators behind how that is deployed and how that violence is enacted. And so
what we're looking at from really any ruling perspective in a capitalist state right now is something I call the collapsing box. The collapsing box is sort of how these leaders of these sort of maintenance workers of the status quo in capitalism view what civilization actually is now in this moment of catastrophe and collapse that we live in amid climate change and mass migration. Within the box, you have habitable lands and the means of survival. And as the habitable lands shrink and the supplies and the means of survival shrink, the solution will never be to try to make more land habitable or try to get more resources out to the places where they no longer exist. It is to push more people out of the box, to strengthen the thresholds of the box so people can't get in, hoard the resources there, and containerize unuseful people within the box to control their access to the means of survival, which is how we wind up with, you know, prisons, for example, having undrinkable water, having inedible food. And this is fully normalized. And this is something we deeply have to consider when we think about how fascism functions and how it escalates, that the means of manufacturing premature death are already fully functional in our society. Those structures don't have to be built. They merely have to be escalated. And that, very importantly, the work of getting people to ignore what happens within those systems has already been done. Like, people live oblivious to what is happening in prisons. And in my experience, even some of the people who are very politically engaged have a level of ambivalence or lack of awareness or emotional intelligence about what imprisoned people actually experience. You know, I'm a volunteer in a program called PNAP, Prison Neighborhood Arts Project, right? Yay for PNAP. I'm a community advisor, so I work with University Without Walls students and prison students who are working to get their degrees. And we wound up in a really tough situation this summer because Stateville Prison is slated for closure. So we had to really hurry up and try to get our students who were close to graduation to their review board process so they could graduate, because they're about to be scattered around the state. That's happening as I speak. A lot of them are already transferred to we know not where, and we know, and it's going to be very, very laborious to try to restore any level of communication, let alone restore the beautiful community that these folks have built. Now, some people celebrate this closure of this prison as a major victory. I understand that perspective, but given that none of these men were freed and there is a $900 million facility that is slated to be built in its place, it's hard for me to experience it that way. But whether you view it as a win, you know, with conditions, or if you see it as just the system continuing to do what it does, I haven't heard a whole hell of a lot of people talking about how they can support our comrades inside who are being scattered around the state. Folks aren't asking what they need, how can we help them? Like, PNAP is going to be working to reunite these men. There are efforts underway in the coming months to get people transferred back to a shared facility somewhere so that we can restore some semblance of the community and we can continue our work with them. My student managed to graduate the day before. He finished his review board the day before they transferred him. Other students that I'd become friends with, that I'd developed mentoring relationships with, were transferred before I could even get back to the prison to see them. And one of them managed to leave a letter for me with someone else. And the last line of that letter communicated that a group of people committed to with a group of people who are committed to solidarity, all things are possible. And this was stated in the hopes that we would meet again, even though we don't know. We just don't know. Within the bureaucracy, I'm not allowed to write letters or visit people outside the educational process, and the educational process is very complicated to arrange. So there's a lot of grief amongst these men right now. There is grief amongst those of us who are connected to them. And there's a lot of, I think, ambivalence amongst people debating, is this a win? Isn't this a win? Like, what about the human beings, right? If we don't care about what they're going through, if we aren't talking about how we can support them, then the people who are just deeply disconnected from everything that's happening in prisons, like, what do we expect from them? They've already shut all of this off in order to function. So I've said a lot there, but I really want us to think about who is already invisibilized and how that impacts, you know, this concept of griefability, you know, because we're not even, if we can't even relate to people, if we can't even have an ongoing sort of empathy for their lived experience, then how can we grieve them?
Thank you all so much. I was going to speak, you know, about the genocide and the ongoing Nakba and what I've been thinking about of this, but I think, Lydia, you covered it so well with this question of, you know, what I've come to see as, like, the psychological warfare that not just Palestinians on the ground, but those of us in the diaspora and those of us who are committed to witnessing and holding Palestinian humanity, no matter what our ethnicities or backgrounds are, that we have been, that the state of Israel has been waging a very expensive psychological war on all of us. When they, you know, bomb hospitals, they tell us that Palestinians bomb them themselves, right? That when we count our dead, they tell us that those numbers are made up. And the reality is that this is an extension of over 75 years of this war on Palestinian memory and on Palestinian existence. And so I think you captured that very well, right? How do you grieve something that is constantly contested in itself, right? As like, so much so that your own vision of reality, right, is constantly being, you know, there's a war literally on our psyches, right? On our ability to believe the thing that we're seeing with our very eyes, to see something that makes sense as sensical, right? And I think that this is a tool, right? This is a tool that settler colonialism in particular has used, but many other oppressive systems have used. And I think, Kelly, you talked about, you know, the dehumanization aspect. And so I think that I think you both covered two of the main things that I wanted to talk about. So instead, I'll focus on how do we grieve something that's never ended? you know, something ongoing is ungrievable, right? Like a death in our, you know, as a migrant, one of the experiences that I've had, and I am going to cry for sure, is that the number of people that you lose and you're not able to participate in any of the rituals, right? Like my family is half Egyptian, half Palestinian, and on the Egyptian side of my family, much of my family is politically exiled. And my grandmother recently passed away alone in her apartment, unable to be reached by any of her family members who had all been exiled. And I recognize this as a recurring experience of people just disappearing and us not getting to be there, right? Like, how do you grieve when you can't go to the funeral, when you never get to wash the body, when, you know, you never get to pray in the mosque after they're dead? Like, you know, and I think that there's this way in which the Nakba, right, is this ongoing, it's never ended, right? My 80-year-old uncle, who I visited recently in Jordan, who was twice displaced by the state of Israel, first as a small child, and again after the Nakba in 1967, sits on his phone and watches videos over and over all day, every day, of the Nakba continuing against a new set of people. And there is this sense that not only is the Nakba not recognized, right, as an event, right, that we are constantly told. I remember giving a presentation about Palestine in junior high, and this Zionist kid in my class, after the presentation, he turned to this map on the wall of the class, you know, it was like geography class or whatever, like world studies or whatever, and he said, well, point to Palestine on the map. And like, your people made the map. And now you're telling me we're not on it. Like, but this is, you know, like those of us who speak publicly about Palestine, like this is our everyday reality of being told over and over and over in like dozens of hundreds of comments and replies and emails, like you're making it up, you're making it up, you're making it up, you're making it up. And that has an enormous toll, right? So it's both the never ending and the unacknowledged quality, right? And the inability to participate in, you know, for those of us, especially in all of us, really, you know, the inability to actually do any of the things that you're supposed to do to grieve our dead, either individually or collectively. And I think ultimately, as leftists, right, to zoom out a little bit more and stay with me here, that we don't get to grieve the version of our lives that we would have lived in a liberated world. Like, that we are constantly being gaslit, just like Palestinians are being gaslit about the Nakba, right? We are all being gaslit about all of this. Right? We are being told that, like, if you're on the streets, it's your fault. If you, you know, if you have credit card debt, it's like you weren't responsible enough, right? Like, that, like, if you can't manage childcare, it's because, like, you're just, like, a bad time manager, right? It's not because, like, you've been given an impossible task, right? If you can't, like, if you haven't figured out how to, like, if you haven't figured out how to, like, get out of fucking bed in the morning after watching, like, dozens and dozens of people die on your phone in the most horrific ways with your money, then you're just too sensitive and you're like, you're being too, you know? And like, the reality is none of this is normal. None of this is just. None of this is good. None of this is fair. And it could have been different. It could have been different. We could have led different lives. And so, like, the colonization of our minds to think that this was all inevitable and that this is all too complicated to fix, right, bars us from the right to grieve what could have been, to grieve the liberation that we're still working for. That when I think about my life, that I'm at 35 years old, that, like, I've already lived 35 years under this and I don't know how many more I'm going to live. I have a right to grieve that. You have a right to grieve that. So yeah. So thank you. At the end of the day, we are rendered ungrievable to ourselves. And I'll stop there.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of this year feeling this way. And not being able to get out of bed. And I think we've all been there, probably. It just feels like the extermination is speeding up. Somebody that I love very much, Peter Fraze, wrote a book called Four Futures, and one of those futures was called Exterminism. And I keep messaging him and being like, so, how we doing? And it's real. And I think Kelly sort of beat me to one of what I was going to say about fascism, which is that it is a system that takes pleasure in the death and the destruction, and that it offers that as a compensation for actually making anybody else's life any better, right? It's not even going to make life great for, like, the straight, white, married dudes that Trump and J.D. Vance are sucking up to. It's not even going to make their lives better. But it's going to give them the compensatory pleasure of enjoying our misery and enjoying our deaths. And, like, absolutely fucking not. And so before I open it up to the floor, I just want to talk about care and invite all of you to talk about care, because we are thinking in our, you know, in just moments, in, you know, in talking about this, and again, writing this book, I was doing things that journalists aren't supposed to do, and sort of reaching across the table and holding someone's hand. And you're not supposed to do that, right? I'm supposed to be separate. I'm supposed to be serious and whatever the hell. And, like, no. And so, like, there are little tiny ways that I've changed how I move through the world. And then there are huge ways that I've changed how I move through the world. And I've talked to so many people about, like, what does a movement look like that has space for our whole lives? And one of the places that I found this actually was talking to former coal miners in Britain. And because the nationalized industry, they felt like it was theirs, even though it was still really dangerous and it still was more likely to kill you than not. And the union built this whole world, you know, and it built the Miners' Welfare Hall, which was where you had a beer after work, but it was also where you got married and where you had your funeral and where your kids, you know, had their birthday parties. And it paid for the football pitch where your kids played football. And when the mines closed, they lost all of that. And that was what the movement looked like, right? It was a space for your whole life, not just for where you organized the strike. And yeah, I just keep thinking, like, how do we build those spaces? And this conference is actually like a lovely place to prefigure some of that. But yeah, so before we open it up to the floor, I would just want to ask each of you to talk about how CARE is showing up in the organizing you're doing. Do you want to start, Kelly?
Sure. The first thing I want to name is that CARE, very much like grief, is rebellious work in these times, because both of these are about a refusal to abandon people, a refusal to simply let the dehumanization and the annihilatory violence proceed without any kind of intervention. And you know, I'm thinking about the legacies of harm reduction in our communities. That for some people, direct action and care work have always overlapped. People have always had to defy laws and norms in order to keep each other alive and do the things that would help them get through yet another day. I experienced this myself in my 20s. This year, I have 15 years of no longer using heroin. Thank you. And in that context of active use in my 20s, I both witnessed the ways in which some people are deemed as sort of responsible for their own circumstances or categorized as sort of what a shame, but there's a sense of inevitability that attaches. Or sometimes I think that people refuse to grieve or attach emotion to a situation because it's so big it's unfathomable to them. They cannot process that. And I think that that's the reality of the opioid crisis for a lot of people. It's so big, people can't even begin to get their heads around it. But I also saw the work that people who were disregarded by society did to keep each other alive. And the work that people whose politics set them apart from all this bizarro meritocracy that disqualified us from the means of survival, people who saw through that bullshit, the organized work that they did to help people keep themselves alive another day. I think we have a lot to learn from those legacies of care. There is a book called Saving Our Own Lives by Ashira Hassan that is an amazing chronicle of some of this care work and some of these lineages. I highly recommend checking that out. I also just want to say a bit about my people, the Menominee people. Our survival is miraculous. We have already survived an apocalypse. And that is one of the things that gives me the most hope in these times. We lost 3/4 of our population in 1 year to smallpox. That was just 1 year in decade after decade of siege and survival. Of the only reason that we are still here was a commitment to reciprocity. And even white scholars who have studied us will acknowledge this. It was a culture of reciprocity that allowed the Menominee people to endure into the reservation era. It was considered un-Menominee to let someone starve if you had food. Our understanding of a future was that we must keep as many of us alive as possible for as long as possible, and this permits a future to exist. That commitment is why we're still here. It is also a cultural knowledge that the settler colonial state set out to destroy by any means necessary. The architects of our assimilation were very blatant in their use of the language that, like, we must destroy the sense of community. We must instill individualism. Like, they said these things very plainly because they knew that our communal relationships were our power and that as individuals we are weak. And convincing the people to be strong, like to be a stronger me instead of a stronger we, is how they make us helpless in the face of their violence. And so I am constantly returning to that cultural knowledge and that the reality that we have already survived an apocalypse with this cultural knowledge. And so that potential exists, and it exists in all of us. And we need to relearn
what we were conditioned to forget as a means of getting us to participate in this death-making system.
I want to say that, you know, I think that we need to do a lot of individual care work and mutual aid. I also think we need to care for our movements as a whole, right? And I think part of that is about, you know, we're in a moment right now, I know, especially in the kind of Palestine liberation movement, of fatigue, intense fatigue. We haven't had time to grieve. We're tired. We're dismayed. I think people, especially with this like electoral shit show, to use technical language, you know, there's this sense of like an impasse. And what happens in movements in those moments, right, is that we start to lash out at the people that are closest to us. Kelly, I think you said this in a tweet, in part because they can feel it, right? We want to inflict harm, right? Like, we want to feel powerful. We want to feel like we can do something. And the people that we can actually harm are our comrades and people within the movement. And so that's part of it. The other part is that we're just frustrated, right? And we are tired. And our enemies are so far away, right? Like, they're not... I mean, the DNC was such a perfect reflection of that, because it was like we were barricades and barricades and barricades blocks away from the ruling elite that we were trying to send a message to and to disrupt, right? And I think many of us feel like we're barricades away from the people, our actual political enemies. And so we feel like we can't get to them, right? So we're kind of just lashing out all around us. And I think the thing that we can do to care for ourselves, to care for our movements, to care for our comrades, to care for the people that we're fighting for, including ourselves, is to take a deep fucking breath before you post on Instagram about other leftists, for God's sake. Like, think for a moment. Like, who am I going after? My friend that I disagree with, or that has made a mistake, or am I going after my enemy? Like, there is such a difference between a conversation that should be had in private and a conversation that should be had in public. Our movements have different flanks. Our movements have different actors within them. Do not confuse your friends for your enemies. That's what ops try to get you to do, okay? And people who function as ops, even if they're not actually ops, right? Like, so that care work is about staying clear-eyed, is staying strategic, is thinking, what next, right? If I do this, what next? How does this help, right? And listen, I get it. I have that instinct sometimes too. And you know what I do? I just turn off my phone or just stop taking phone calls for a few days. Do the work to take care of yourself. You don't have to burn something if you're getting burnt out, you don't need to burn down the organization that's been burning you out on the way out. You don't need to. You can just step on back and let somebody else step on up. Okay? That's recognize that when your instinct is to be like, and these people aren't revolutionaries, and these people aren't revolutionaries, and these people aren't revolutionaries, boo, you're not in a good place. Step on back. Step on back. Take a break. Take a break. Don't burn it down on your way out. None of us benefit from that. So that's the care work that I think needs to be part of this moment.
I'm a little intimidated now to say something after that, because I love every bit of it. So I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. I echo, ditto everything that has been said. I also, something that I am really thinking about. So I live as many of the days as the University of Kentucky will allow me to be in the city of New Orleans, but I do teach. So I do spend a lot of my days also in the state of Kentucky. And I've been thinking about, in the last 6 months or a year, I have been really fortunate to be a marginal member of this coalition, Building Communities, Not Prisons, that's organizing to stop a new federal prison from being built in eastern Kentucky, specifically a place called Letcher County, which is a place with a long history of organizing and struggle against you know, the coal miner companies, all against mountaintop removal, all of these different kind of spaces. The incredible folks that work with Apple Shop, that's a media center in Appalachia that folks should definitely check out if you're not familiar with, right, have been doing incredible work in the region for decades. So last spring, there was what is a common thing when they are debating the siting of a new prison somewhere, which is there was an environmental review process that meant that the Bureau of Prisons came to Letcher County, specifically to this town, Whitesburg, which is such a beautiful place, to, you know, have community input, right, on the federal prison. Now, this is the second time this campaign has been waged because the federal prison was offered, proposed, shut down, and then reproposed a couple years later, right? So there's a kind of long history around this struggle. So there I was with many other folks, right? So folks from across Kentucky, folks from Letcher County, folks from D.C. who had previously been locked up in the federal system and were the folks who would be them and their loved ones because they're from D.C. who would be most likely to be locked up in this federal prison if it was to be built, environmentalists, folks from other places who have been doing work, really important legal work across the country in support of this campaign. So there we were. And there was a really beautiful kind of pre-meeting that Apple Shop hosted for us. Before we all went to the high school. And we all sat in a cafeteria, I believe that it was. And the federal prison folks were like, we're going to hear comments from all the sides, right? And I was really prepared. I am a good political economic abolitionist geographer. So, like, I had my facts. We had all the coalition had talking points. I was ready to say all kinds of things. And as the folks got up, mostly, and it was notable, right? Like, who were in favor of the prison, mostly elderly folks, right? What became really clear in those moments was how sad they were about the loss of a potential future of their town, right? Which is something I knew in the abstract. And we'd even talked about it in the kind of lead up to it, right? Some of the lovely folks from Letcher County said, we're going to see our neighbors and they're going to be on the other side of them, us. And we're going to go and we're going to hug them because we're mountain people and this is what we do. We are not going to throw away our neighbors in this moment. We are trying to get folks to come to this other side, right? And as I was sitting there, the grief was so palpable in the room, right? Because what folks are actually in the fight about, it was not the residents of this town, those who are on the prison side, when many residents are also against the prison, right? But they are worried about the future, right? It is not a surprise to me that the school superintendent had sent out an email that very day, right, to all the teachers to ask them to come out in support of the prison in the hope there would be more children for the future, right? So what they were grieving was a future for an Appalachia that has been disinvested in, rendered as disposable, said all kinds of shit by someone not even from Appalachia named J.D. Vance, right? And when I got up to speak, right, after hearing all this, right, all of a sudden I had to change everything in my tone, right? I was like, I wish this prison would bring jobs. But I don't actually, because I don't want anyone locked up, right? But I wish that there was this future. But what are the other futures, right? And I watched the most beautiful organizing happen in that moment. Folks not yelling at their neighbors, right? Not actually trying to convince the Bureau of Prisons that they were going to change their minds, but using this moment as an opportunity. And I witnessed, right, particularly profoundly, as these guys who had been locked up in federal prisons in the region, Appalachia, and now we're back home in D.C., get up and tell their stories about what it meant to be so far from their families, to be locked up, of the kinds of violence they experienced. And I saw something that was notable to me, which is there was an elderly couple sitting right in front of me, right, who were definitely came in on the pro-prison side, right? Definitely applauded every time the pro-prison folks came up. And I watched, not the man, but the wife, all of a sudden start applauding for our side, right? I watched and her husband looked at her and he was not happy. And she said, these aren't jobs for us. These are jobs based on locking these people up. Like, it was this transformative moment, actually, right? And I don't know what else happened, but I remember watching in that room as folks came over. They asked for materials. They asked for the side. They had nice chats. They said, like, people just don't want to hear the truth. But, like, what else is possible, right? And so I'm saying this story that might seem a little outside of this idea of care, but I'm also thinking about how do we approach all of these moments, assuming, right, if something like a prison benefits almost no one and so therefore almost anyone can be organized, right? How are we approaching these moments from a place that is principled, right? Not trying to meet people to where they're at in a very kind of liberal, narrow kind of way, but actually in a way that's about having the conversation of what does the kind of care work look like to hearing what's actually going on underneath the surface and what does it mean to actually be bringing more people in so we're able to build out the kinds of movement infrastructures we are rather than simply denouncing folks who are seeing this crisis of social reproduction and are desperate for a solution. And if the state is only offering one, what does it do for us to do the caring work of offering other kinds of ideas and openings and opportunities to join us if this is what we're actually a different kind of world we're trying to win?
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.